I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. By all accounts, Heather Heyer was relentless in her fight for human rights. She was killed last Saturday when she was protesting against the neo-Nazis, members of the KKK, and white supremacists in Charlottesville who clash with counter-demonstrators and threaten peaceful protesters. Her mother spoke at her funeral yesterday to an overflowing crowd of mourners.
Because here's the message. Although Heather was a caring and compassionate person, so are a lot of you. A lot of you go that extra mile. And I think the reason that what happened to Heather has struck a chord is because we know that what she did is achievable. We don't all have to die. We don't all have to sacrifice our lives. They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her.
Her father, barely holding back tears, called on everyone to put down hate and to forgive and love each other. Thousands of people marched in Philadelphia last night, responding to the vitriol and violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. The Philadelphia rally wanted to send a message about solidarity with last week's victims and to shed light on white supremacy and racism in the city of brotherly love. President Trump's blaming of both sides in Charlottesville and his unwillingness to truly condemn the hateful and racist and anti-Semitic rhetoric has reignited a debate and a discussion about our tense racial climate, the raw emotions that have been exposed, and our history. We have been here before. Let me introduce our three guests. Mark Kelly Tyler is pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church here in Philadelphia, one of the organizers of last night's march against white supremacy. And Mark Kelly Tyler, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us is Howard Stevenson, and he's a psychologist, a professor. In fact, he's the Constance Clayton Professor of Urban Education, Professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. He's also the director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative and Forward Promise. Howard Stevenson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Rabbi Mordecai Liebling. He's director of the Social Justice Organizing Program at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, which is just outside of Philadelphia. He was in Charlottesville last weekend, and I should add he is the son of Holocaust survivors. And Mordecai Liebling, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
An honor to be here.
I'm not sure who to put this to, but perhaps to you, Mark, I'll begin. When David Duke praises something that you have said, is it time to choose which side you're on?
Well, I mean, it seems that there should be an obvious answer there. It's unfortunate that the president of the United States doesn't know it. He is who he is. This is what we saw during the campaign as well, his reluctance and, you know, the fact that he even said he didn't know him. And there's, you know, video.
David Duke.
Yes. And there's video of him, you know, actually talking about him years before. It's very troubling. And I wish we could just say that it was just the president's problem. But unfortunately, as we saw over the weekend, a lot of people share those views.
As I said, we have been here before, some
sure.
version of this. But is this one of those moments when you feel as a country we need to decide who we are and what we stand for, what our values are?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a clarifying moment for us. And, you know, but I want to push that narrative and remind listeners, especially, you know, my white brothers and sisters who are out there, that racism, systemic racism and white supremacy is not a Southern narrative only. And so it's easy to get caught up in, you know, what happened there. And as we see, you know, neo-Nazis and skinheads and people like that. But we also have to look at the structural things that happen in places like Philadelphia that account for the schools looking the way they do, the lack of police accountability, where an officer can shoot a black man in the back and be around on the force 7 years later to do it again. Those are the issues that we really have to talk about. So, yeah, let's stand with Charlottesville, but also let's press here at home.
Mordecai Liebling, you were both in Charlottesville, and you spoke last night as well. What did you say last night?
Well, last night I said that it's very important for us to stand up for love every time in the face of hatred, that we cannot allow those expressions of hatred to go unchecked. I also said that it is no accident that we have such polarity in our country right now. We have the most extreme wealth and income gap since the Civil War. It is that extreme gap in wealth that's at the bottom line of the extreme political polarity we have in the country today, that we really need to address the extremism of wealth, and that by that way we address the other extremisms in this country.
I want to pick up on all of that. Let me get you in on the conversation, Howard Stevenson, and we wanted you to come here as a psychologist, and I think psychologists have a lot to tell us about who we are, but also how we deal with this level of conflict and vitriol.
Yeah, I think to echo my colleagues here, the important thing to think about white supremacy is it's not just a blatant violence, it's also a psychological violence. And to what degree we want to think about it as trauma, many of us are concerned about how our children are thinking about this. What do we say to our children? How do we navigate? And part of the work that we've been doing around the importance of racial socialization, how do you prepare young people for this emotionally, is that a lot of our approaches to these issues are legal. We're hoping to hold people accountable or punish those who violate, and that doesn't address the sort of emotional trauma that we all go through and the hurt and pain that affects not only us psychologically but physiologically, including sleep. And if you thought talking to your children would improve about race, would improve their sleep habits, I think that's a more relevant way to consider what psychological violence does in terms of white supremacy that's both blatant and but also, as my colleagues have alluded to, very, very invisible and subtle.
I can't tell you how many people have said to me how upset they were, not in Charlottesville, but how upset they have been watching what happened there. I watched the Vice video that really is a documentation of how white supremacists feel about Jews and about African Americans, about themselves. It's all very disturbing. On the other hand, it's out in the open. I mean, in certain ways, the KKK people, they didn't have hoods on. You could see them. You could see the Mordecai as they walked down the street.
Right. I think a symptom of the moral unraveling of our country is the fact that they could walk around without hoods on. And you could see such angry faces. I have never seen that kind of hatred spewing out of people.
Truly.
Truly hatred, you know, and chanting blood and soil, which is a traditional Nazi slogan. And parenthetically, for Trump to challenge Obama's birth certificate was an example of blood and soil. It really is exactly that. Yeah. And, you know, when they were chanting, Jews will not replace us. You will not replace us. Jews will not replace us. Eric Ward, the senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, has just written a very insightful piece about how anti-Semitism is so much at the core of white supremacy today.
Even more than I don't want to compare, you know, who's more targeted by white supremacists.
It's a very bizarre bizarre train of thought. So in Eric Ward's piece, he explains how the white supremacists had to explain how did the black community manage to overthrow Jim Crow. If in white supremacist language, black people aren't smart enough to do that, how could they do that? Must be the Jews who did it. They're behind it. And gay and lesbian people aren't strong enough to overturn gay marriage laws, so who could have done it? Oh, it must be the Jews. The Jews are behind it. So in white supremacist rhetoric, the Jews are behind all of it. We're back to the international conspiracy of Jews controlling the world. And he talks about it as the engine that drives white supremacy in the United States today.
Let me turn to you, Mark, I want to just give you a chance to respond. As I said, and as was obvious, we heard the president, we saw these people, we heard them. Does that allow us to be more honest and realistic, grappling with who we are and even our history?
Well, it should. I mean,
these people are not hiding from us anymore.
That's exactly right. And, you know, my mother grew up in Arkansas. I was thinking of last night, Mordecai's story about his parents being Holocaust survivors was, it was probably one of the most powerful moments for me last night. And I couldn't help but think of my own mother, who's in her 80s now, grew up in Arkansas in the 1930s. And you're talking about somebody, again, being scarred by that moment. But the thing that she would often say to me, raising us in California, she was a part of the Great Migration. She said, in Arkansas, we always knew where white people stood. If they were there for you, you knew it. And if they weren't, they just told you, don't come around here. We don't want you. She said, in California, you never knew. Wow. And you had to really kind of wonder. And I remember growing up those experiences of people that I thought were friends who would just, The first time I was called, you know, the N-word was from a person who I would go over his house after school with. You know, we were in the same school, in a Catholic school. So, you know, it was that watershed moment that this is what she means. And so I'm personally, I don't want to see it at all, but I'd rather see it out front without the mask and let me know who you are so I know what I'm dealing with.
Howard, we had on yesterday a former skinhead who now works to help people leave that movement and in a sense rehabilitate themselves. And he talked about how damaged they were. And there is a question about, you know, loving, and this religious people have to struggle with this stuff, loving people who hate you. But as a psychologist, how do we do that?
Right. Well, I think the message around love is very important. I think part of the idea is if you dehumanize people who dehumanize you, how are you different? That's one question to raise, both spiritually, religiously, but also psychologically. And the cost of hating on me, on myself, on my family, on my children is amazing. And we don't talk about that enough. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Margaret Spencer, has been working on this idea about the downside of privilege or the downside of supremacy. And that is, how do you live in a world trying to prove that you're better than other people when that's not the truth? That's not the case. You're living a lie, and that has an effect on you emotionally. And it's a form of dehumanization in and of itself. But love gives you the opportunity to say, you know, people aren't necessarily evil, but they succumb to the spirit of evil. And in that sense, you are choosing evil as opposed to you and your humanity is somehow different than my humanity. And when we go to children, we try to teach them the same thing, not to dehumanize haters or hate the haters, but to understand how their tragedy, right, has been expressed in this way, but you don't have to swallow that Kool-Aid of inferiority, right, if that makes any sense.
It makes a lot of sense, and it also reminds me of the people in the church who spoke to about Dylann Roof, about forgiving him for the massacre. I'm looking at you, Mark. I mean, the massacre in that church 2 years ago in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, some people have a real hard time with it. I mean, they really do. And even people who are in the church have a hard time with it. As I said to you, I think a couple of years ago, I can't imagine if that happened to me, being
me
in
neither.
A position
yeah.
to do it. And I would imagine that those people who were able to forgive never would have thought they could. But again, I think it goes back to what Dr. Stevenson is saying, that it's about choices and that they chose in that moment, probably spontaneously, to go with love as opposed to live in hate the rest of their lives. And it's liberating if you can get there. I just want to go back to one earlier point that Doc said.
You know what, hold on,
sure.
only because we're just seconds
Thanks.
Away from a break, and then I'll get right back
Thanks.
To you. That's Mark Kelly Tyler. He's pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church here in Philadelphia, one of the organizers of last night's March Against White Supremacy that took place here in Philadelphia. Rabbi Mordecai Liebling is director of the Social Justice Organizing Program at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. He spoke last night. He was in Charlottesville, Virginia, last weekend, the son of Holocaust survivors. And Howard Stevenson with us as well. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, a psychologist as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about where we go from here. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thousands of Philadelphians marched last night against racism and hate. It was on display at the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, last weekend. As the nation has tried to understand the violence and revealed what it all means, many Americans are shocked by the president's seeming defense of the actions and ideology the Klansmen, white supremacists, and neo-Nazis. This hour, we are continuing our coverage and conversation about the aftermath of Charlottesville. And again, joining us, Reverend Mark Kelly Tyler, Rabbi Mordecai Liebling, and psychologist Howard Stevenson. Mark, you wanted to say something right before the break, and then we'll get some folks
sure.
in on the conversation.
Thanks. And first of all, I just want to just say that the march was organized by Power. Philadelphians organized to witness, empower, and rebuild. Our clergy caucus, and Rabbi Mordecai was certainly also part of the organizing of it, so I don't want us to get in trouble with our clergy colleagues taking
no,
credit.
No, you don't want to do that.
It was a big tent that helped pull that together, trust me.
And you pulled it together in about 48 hours, we should add.
Yeah, it started with the call. We wanted to hear from Mordecai, who was in Charlottesville, what happened, and he told us, and that led to us deciding to do it. But at the end of the march in Arch Street United Methodist Church, a young white guy came to me, maybe in his 20s, And talking about Dr. Stevenson's earlier point about the violence that happens, psychological violence, and he comes to me and he says, you know, my friends and I were in Charlottesville, and we really didn't want to come to this march because we didn't want to relive that pain. He said, but something happened to me here tonight. I mean, he's almost in tears. And it was like this, a lot of the clergy last night were saying how many of the people were coming to us almost in this religious way, not necessarily identifying as being religious, but just really wanted to talk. And he said that it was such a powerful moment for him and so important to be there to let that stuff go.
Yeah. Mordecai, why did you want to go to Charlottesville?
Well, for a few reasons. One, as the son of Holocaust survivors, I feel it's my legacy and responsibility to stand up against that kind of hatred all of the time. You know, it's on some level, it's a part of my own healing process to not allow that to happen. You know, Dr. Stevenson and I were talking for a minute about generational trauma. You know, and one of the ways you deal with generational trauma is to say, okay, I recognize what happened. I'm going to participate in making sure that never happens again. It's giving me agency. It's very important for people whose parents, grandparents, or selves have suffered some kind of trauma to have agency, to be able to stand up and say, I am not going to let this happen again. Mm-hmm. So that is an important part of what I was there. And I think it's really important for clergy people to stand up for God, for love, for caring against hatred, to show that religion is alive and active today. And, you know, one of the gratifying parts of being down there was so many Jews coming up to me and say, thank you, Rabbi, for being out here today.
Mm-hmm. I was also thinking of people either who had fought in the Second World War or whose fathers or grandfathers or perhaps grandmothers had some association with that war. The kind of trauma, I mean, we know what war can do to a country, but certainly due to the people who fight it and their children and grandchildren is a kind of trauma that can live on.
Oh, absolutely. And when you think about post-traumatic stress, sometimes we think of it in the context of war. But you could imagine over generations how that's transferred, whether stories are shared about how you both cope with that trauma, but also how we didn't always cope with that trauma. You know, the silence to protect our communities was also sometimes not healing because we didn't get a chance to let go of that pain. And I would argue, too, that you could look at slaves and enslaved Africans in this country as also giving their lives for the building of this country is another part of that narrative that says, you know, not only did those who went to war give their lives to sacrifice for the values of this country, but enslaved folks also contributed to the building of this country and the wealth of this country. And this gap, it becomes very important when you think about who died in service for this country.
And then you think of the Confederate flag or perhaps a statue to Robert E. Lee. I wonder, too, whether – if I can go back to you, Howard, but I'd love to hear Mark and you, Mordecai, respond to this as well. Trying to understand the people on the other side, the white supremacists.
Yes.
First of all, trying to understand what that anger is about. Yeah. And is there goodness there?
Oh, please. Wherever there's humanity, and I think back to the spiritual points that we've all been trying to make, that none of us have the right or the moral authority to claim someone else isn't human. And that, and in a spiritual warfare, that this evil that's around us that we can choose or not choose is a battle. And folks who've been deprived, and we know there are lots of folks who've been deprived economically, and this is the expression they're trying to say or use to get through that deprivation. There are other ways to get through that deprivation, but it's okay that we can try to listen to that pain and heal and see that as trauma too without somehow siding with that evil or that hate.
Because these are hurt people?
Absolutely.
Do you want to respond to that, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, there's the Vice News story that was out there.
Yep. Worth seeing, I have to say, very troubling.
It is. And
worth seeing.
The young guy who I guess they focused on the most, they were kind of with him before and after the march and during. Just hearing him, you know, that pain sounds very familiar.
Does it?
Right, it does. And so he's directing his anger in the wrong place. But I know that voice and this idea that somehow, you know, I've been cut out. I've been left out. Somebody's working against me. There's some, you know, mysterious force back here. And, you know, again, there's this emptiness. I mean, and not to mention being fed lies that are easy to hold on to. I mean, he's talking about Tamir Rice being this bad actor who deserved to get killed. I'm like, what part of the Tamir Rice story did you actually read?
Yeah.
But I'm certain that there must be a lie that was given him, or Trayvon Martin. I mean, walking. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a human condition. And I think that is the part that we miss. And that's why I appreciate what Dr. Stevenson said earlier, that there's a certain part that we have to legislate against, mm-hmm. and we have to do the legal part. But there is another part that laws will never address. And that's the tough part.
You want to weigh in on this?
Absolutely. We certainly have to differentiate between the ideological leaders of the white supremacists and many of their followers. They're preying on the pain mm-hmm. of these young men. Mm-hmm. Real wages in America haven't gone up for 25 years. Mm-hmm. Most of these guys don't feel they have any opportunity for advancement in their lives. They're angry. They were promised something. What they were promised, they're not getting. And then people are reaching out to them, recruiting them, and say, oh, it's their fault that you're mm-hmm. not getting what you want. You know, it's classic scapegoating. You know, many years ago, Dr. Du Bois wrote about the white wages, the wages of racism, yeah. right? Mm. And, you know, so when there is economic deprivation, what white people have been fed is, at least you're better than those folks, or it's those folks' fault. So it's classic. That's why I said earlier, it's during the times of extreme difference in wealth that racism mm-hmm. is going to become more virulent in public, because that's how you're going to appease a lot of angry people. Mm-hmm. So the importance of reaching out humanly to those folks is crucial, because that's how we form coalitions to really bring about the kind of justice that we need.
Were you able to have any semblance of that conversation with the white supremacists that you saw in Charlottesville?
You can't do it in the middle of a demonstration. The time to do that is before then, after then, not in a moment of conflict. You have to build relationships and talk to people, not under that kind of stress. It's possible to do, but not in the moment of battle.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, too, whether people feel more empowered, Howard, when they're in a crowd. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, what you might say in a crowd, you might not say if you're by yourself.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're in a situation of trauma, one of the challenging aspects is being isolated. Does anybody else go through what I've gone through? And if you have some semblance of support, you might be willing to take risks that because you're feeling some relief from the isolation, that you might go a little farther than you would ever expect and be very guilty about after the fact. How in the world did I do that? How in the world could I have gone that far? Mm. And especially if you see yourself on television or in video and seeing it live in a way, that's very different than your own sort of inner turmoil of trying to address that pain, right? And feeling that false sense of camaraderie, which I think it really is a false sense of camaraderie.
That's Howard Stevenson. He's a professor of urban education and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is Rabbi Mordecai Liebling, a director of social justice organizing program at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. And I should say he was in Charlottesville over the weekend, last weekend. And rounding out our trio of guests, Reverend Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church, and both Mordecai and Mark were part of the organizing of last night's demonstration of support for the victims in Charlottesville, and also a rally and march against racism and hate in our own city here in Philadelphia. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. And it looks like we have Thomas, who's calling us from East Norriton. Thomas, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
I taught sociology for like 6 years at Drexel, so I just wanted to say that we call that the contagion theory, the mob mentality going riots and things like that. But the reason for my call was that I wanted to make sure, which you guys are touching on, is that this issue with the Charlottesville is not narrowed down to this just narrative, that it's a macro narrative, a macrocosmic narrative that set the climate for this to occur, which one of the hosts commented on, one of the panelists commented on, as far as the institutional and systemic discrimination and racism, which is not just economic, but it's also policy. It's in our school system. It's also in an image portrayed by the fourth estate, which we refer to as the mass media. So now, if you have these images that you continue to depict as someone as less human, then what happens is we have a legal law enforcement entity that are able to kill people on camera and not be prosecuted. So it goes with the perception of how we see people, and ultimately also, which your panel touched on, love. That's what we need. We need sure. the love to acknowledge each other as equal and love one another, but also not be befuddled by the press in this single narrative. There's a mm-hmm. larger narrative. Narrative
Absolutely. Is- Thomas, thanks so much for calling into Radio Times. And it is true. I'll put this to you, Mark. It is true that if there were something that erupted, for instance, in your rally, mm-hmm. the march last night, what would have gotten the attention?
Well, of course. I mean, that's, people wanted to know about the Rizzo statue, for example. And many people in our group support it coming down, but that's not what we were marching about last night. And again, if there was, one little drop of violence, then that would have dominated the narrative. So we're just happy that the demands that were put on the table were actually picked up on today. Doesn't always happen.
Doesn't always happen. Mm-hmm. Here's a tweet from Stephen. This is to you, Howard. Please help me understand how they are hurt, these white supremacists.
Mm-hmm. Well, first I'd like to say, as I began in the beginning, supremacy in and of itself is more than what we saw in Charlottesville. It's visible and invisible, and my colleagues have commented on that. And so to the degree that the recent caller talked about invisible, you want to think about supremacy broader than what you can actually blatantly see. And what you can't see, though, is the pain that people have gone through to actually get themselves prepared. If you think about what it takes for people who are so threatened that they need a torch and a gun to actually express their voice, it means they're very limited in feeling weak when it comes to, can I say what I really want to say? And so I need all this armor yeah. to be able to actually say, I believe this. And so, but we also know there have been studies on just the declining health. In addition to the issues of income disparity for poor whites, there's also health decline That's right. in poor white communities and middle-class white communities that people are not aware of. And so people who've had this notion of American dream but are still having their kids not go to college, not come home from college, they're not seeing it realized. And so I think health and income disparities mm-hmm. are real traumatizing events that we don't hear enough of those stories that sort of prime the pump of what we see in Charlottesville.
I just want to add another example of that pain is the opioid epidemic.
Yes,
we're looking at
absolutely.
The same people who were victimized by the opioid epidemic. There is an enormous amount of pain, of unfulfilled expectations
yes.
in this country today.
And I think about 80% or larger of that group are whites
yes,
who are struggling
right.
with those issues.
That's
so,
right.
yeah.
I've heard over the last week or so, this is not America. This is not who we are. But I think it is who we are. I mean,
yeah, well,
this is what we have, and we have struggled with this successfully and unsuccessfully for centuries.
Well, that's
now.
The suburban mentality, right?
Right.
And the idea
which
that's,
one?
Well,
because I'm from the suburbs.
That this is not America. This idea that that's not us. Well, look, open your eyes. That is us, right? Us is being pulled over, and instead of just getting a ticket, you end up getting shot because things escalate and you're viewed as a threat from the beginning. And so, America is at 51 years old. I still treat every traffic stop like it could end in a life or death experience.
Yeah.
That's America. My 51-year-old white colleagues in power don't live that way and don't think that way. They don't think, what do I need to tell my 19-year-old son about just, you're 19, you're tall, you've got a great GPA, you're in college on a scholarship, but listen, kid, the police don't know that. So right. act as though, yeah. your life depends on it because it does.
Yeah.
Mordecai, I ran across something that Gore Vidal, I don't know if he wrote this or said this, but that we live in the United States of amnesia.
Mm. Well, we do. We haven't looked at the genocide that we founded this country on of killing. There were, millions of Native Americans on this continent when we arrived, and there were 500,000 at the beginning of the last century. Mm. We have amnesia of slavery. I've done a lot of work in group systems theory. I did a lot of consultation with congregations. And when there's been sexual abuse, for example, in the congregation, and it doesn't get talked about and doesn't get apologized for, that congregation never gets healthy. Mm-hmm. America will not be a healthy country until we come to grips with the genocide of the Native Americans and slavery of African Americans. In order for any system to be healthy, it needs to come to grips with the traumas in that system. Mm-hmm. We haven't done that. We have never apologized to the Native American people. We have never apologized to the African American people. Until there is serious apology and reparations and America comes to grips with its soul, we are not going to be a healthy country.
Does that mean taking down statues of Confederate military leaders?
Absolutely. You know, I need to point to Germany. If you go to Germany now, there are every place Jews were killed, there is a plaque. There is a project in the United States now by a different Dr. Stevenson to put up a plaque wherever there was a lynching in America, right? How would Jews feel if there were statues of Nazi generals in Germany today, right?
Sure.
It's the same thing. We have to, maybe taking down the statues, we will come to grips with the history of hatred in this country.
Right.
About a minute before a break. Howard, it looks like you want to add something.
No, actually, my brother is that other Dr. Stevenson.
Really?
Yes.
He's great. That's your brother?
That's my younger brother.
The other Steven. Okay.
Yeah, I thought I'd throw that in there just so people don't believe me though when I say it.
Giving him a shout out here, right?
But no, his point has been both that, you know, you can't dismantle emotional racism through legal means. You've got to go to the trauma, and Germany's a great example. South Africa's another example around reconciliation. And, you know, if we're going to talk about healing, to what degree do you have to face that tragedy to get over it? And that's true for white nationalists who decide no longer that nationalism and supremacy works for them. They're going to need that similar kind of trauma connection.
I want to pick up on that after our short break. That's Howard Stevenson, I guess the other Howard Stevenson. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the Graduate School of Education, also a psychologist. Rabbi Mordecai Liebling with us as well, director of the Social Justice Organizing Program at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, and Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church here in Philadelphia. You can join our conversation. We're talking about essentially where do we go from here. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking about what next, where do we go from here, after the violence in Charlottesville last weekend and the raw emotions that were on display, how to heal racial wounds and foster greater understanding of our history, of each other and ourselves. Let me get Nicole from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Nicole. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marnie. And your guests, the rally was wonderful last night, and they really are helpful for those of us who were so upset about the events of the weekend. But I would like to know how, I would like advice, I would like guidance, maybe even a workshop on how to talk to my family. Most of the people in my family voted for Trump, and there is no, I have not, and I'm take responsibility for this. I have not found a way to talk to them.
Fair enough.
And they make excuses, and it never goes anywhere. I just get very upset, and they get very upset, and then we don't talk to each other for a while.
Well, so. Nicole, you called the right place. I'm not sure who to start with. Mark, I'm going to start with you. Mark Kelly Tyler.
I was actually going to pass. I was looking at Mordecai. You know, my family, I don't think anybody voted for Trump, so I don't really know what to
but
tell
you. But you know
you.
What she's saying, right?
I do understand what she's saying. But well, honestly, so someone, I was on a different program this morning, and someone raised the question, African-American caller, that yesterday's march was great, but that the crowd was overwhelmingly white. And she thought that was a problem. I said, that's actually a good thing, because if you're talking about ending white supremacy and institutionalized racism in America, white people are going to have to take, you know, center stage in this. Black folk, we've been out here, but we can't do it unless we're all together. So I sympathize with Nicole, and you know, just say to her that this is not easy, right? And really confronting this, it begins in our families, and in our churches, and our synagogues, and our neighborhoods, and then it builds out.
Howard, do you want to help Nicole?
Sure. I mean, it's a tough question. I think for a lot of reasons, family, you almost need a mediator sometimes. One of the problems that's happening around discourse is we don't really have debate. So in debate, it means you've got to listen to the other side. And if both sides are in some kind of pain, the question is, how do I allow time to listen before I attack or before I present my argument? And so for young people, we're trying to say, you know, how can you just prepare to listen, which is a form of love that says, which redefines a narrative of me right, you wrong, me bad, you good, or you bad, me good. And so listening can be a sort of step into that surprises the other expecting the attack. But family is an interesting place because you can pick a lot of things you can't talk with family about. And I know Thanksgiving dinners change for everybody.
Just thinking of Thanksgiving, so, right. We used to look forward to it, and now. Right.
But can Nicole listen? What's it like when she tries to listen? What does she notice when it's very hard to hear? Is one question.
Sure. Let me read an email. Mordecai, I'll put this to you. It's related from Jean. She says, I have a neighbor who has a Confederate flag hanging from... I sent him an anonymous letter asking him to take it down because the message may get out about the type of neighborhood that we live in. How can I, as a white human being, not feel threatened by this flag displayed by my neighbor? And why won't the authorities address it? I mean, we live in America. You're allowed to hang a Confederate flag, but it's a related issue. How do you deal with something
just,
like that?
Well, just, as Dr. Stevenson just said, it begins with listening. Now, it begins with the assumption that this person is probably in some kind of pain, some kind of anger to do this, and to have a conversation, say, I call it a conversation of curiosity. You know, why is it that you have that flag? What does that flag mean to you? What are you saying with that flag? What is it in your life? It's to be able to have that kind of almost dispassionate stepping back for a moment and say, here's another person. I wonder why this person is doing that. It can't be out of love. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And to begin that way. And just to go back to Nicole for a minute, the family is the hardest place to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. So practice on your neighbors first.
The one with the Confederate flag?
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Because it's family, right?
It's family.
They know too much about you.
Nicole, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. A tweet from Rosalind. This morning's discussion has been food for the soul in an otherwise discouraging week. Thanks and hugs. Well, I appreciate that, but picking up on this, I mean, if we can't talk to our families, how do we go from here, Mark? And I wonder whether... You know, whether neo-Nazis, are they having some same version of this discussion among themselves? I don't know. But how do we bridge all these divides that we seem to have?
Well, if it was easy, it would have been done by now. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. So, right. And I think that is the important thing to remember is that as a nation, this is still an experiment, and it's relatively young compared to other countries in the world. And we have such a troubled past that we've not yet dealt with. I mean, again, you know, I'm just a couple of generations away from enslaved people in my family. So it's not like we're talking hundreds of years mm-hmm. here. And so I think that we're going in the right direction. The fact that so many people have walked away from the president in this moment, and some obviously business people because of business decisions, but the fact that he's standing alone and that the military says that's not us, that, you know, other pilots, that's not us. That's saying something. We're not there yet, but we've mm-hmm. got to keep pushing forward. And just as a person of faith, as discouraged as I've been over the mm-hmm. last week or two, I cannot abandon hope. Mm-hmm. That if we continue to work together, that maybe our great-grandchildren will have the world that we've always envisioned, or at least something close to it.
I just want to affirm that we are an experiment in democracy still.
Yeah.
You know, that we are still one of the few multicultural nations in the world trying to have a democracy. We haven't done it really well yet, but that's a yet. We have to work at it. We can't give up in despair right now because we're in the middle of an experiment to create a multicultural democracy.
What do you think white people should do that they haven't done?
Well, I think white people really need to understand how what the role that white supremacy has played institutionally in this country. You know, if you look back at the Social Security Act, if you look back at the Minimum Wage Act, if you look back at how federal lending authorities, you can see that from the 1930s to the 1950s, the white middle class accumulated wealth, and black people were systematically excluded from all of those programs. So that's why we have a country where the average wealth of a white family is 13 times that the average wealth of a black family. That's all because of government policies. It's not an accident. White people need to understand that that difference is because of how white supremacy was baked into the system. That is a place we need to begin to really understand our history. It's not about feeling guilty. It's about understanding how we got here and what are the next steps.
Yeah. And if I'm a white, unemployed white person who's struggling, can I relate to that?
That's the hard part. So we have. That's why we have to create equal opportunity for everybody now. It's the economic injustice that's facing everybody. We need to listen and hear the pain of that young white person, but we also need to be changing a school system and a job system so that young white person can have a job also, and we don't have CEOs earning 500 times as much as the average person in their company.
Howard, yes. Do you want to add something? Then we'll get Craig in on the conversation.
Sure. I think in some respects that ability to listen also includes people telling their own stories. And so allowing to hear what stories people actually have from very different perspectives. I think I used to say in the same regard that I think we're in love with the idea of love, but actual loving is harder.
That's right.
We're in love with the idea of democracy, but our actual being democratic and fair is harder, particularly when it means I have to give up some of my wealth, even if it was built based on the backs of slaves, based on the back mm-hmm. of folks who died in service. It's still mine, and I think those stories aren't told. If I could also say one other thing,
sure.
that when we think of our children, part of this is a political discussion that's adult-like. And with children, trying to explain to them that supremacy is not just what you see in Charlottesville, but it's also invisible. There's this game. We play Monopoly. We learn how people make money. But we don't have teaching people about the game of supremacy. And so we start by saying, you know, anybody who thinks they're better than you, that's part of a supremacy. Right? For you to think that you're better than another person means is a beginning of that same frame in which young people may not understand policies and sort of housing crises for the last, 100
sure,
years.
Sure. Let me get Craig from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Craig, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is this. I think a lot of people in America are finding the words from the president to be very distressing, very upsetting, borderline horrific. And I'm wondering, we saw business leaders resign from his economic council, which was a very positive move, I think. I'm just wondering what to think about the fact that there are so many people who are very close to President Trump in his administration, and even his family, who are Jewish. And I'm wondering if those people are feeling the need to resign, are feeling the need to speak up. We've not heard them become vocal about any of this, and I'm concerned about that.
Well, Craig, I don't know that we can answer your specific question, but I'd like to hear what Rabbi Mordecai Liebling says.
Well, one thing I heard this morning is that the Republican Jewish Coalition has admonished Trump for this and has taken a step away from him. So they're the first sort of Jewish Republican group that has taken a stand on this. Unfortunately, I would say historically there have always been court Jews. There have always
court
been
Jews.
Court Jews who have, worked with ruling powers for their own benefit.
Like capos, in a way.
Capos, court Jews. I don't want to use that word now about some of the Jews around Trump, but not saying anything is a betrayal of their heritage.
Mm-hmm. Let me read some more comments here from Jonathan. My wife and I attended last night's demonstration in Philadelphia. Two things enlivened us. Number one, we were so excited to see so many young people, black, white, Latino, Asian, passionate and focused young people taking peacefully to the streets. Number two, we thank the Philadelphia police for being so professional, making our marches here in Philadelphia safe. They deserve our thanks. Mm-hmm. Mark, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I want to make a distinction between Philadelphia Police Civil Affairs Unit and just regular beat officers, because we were in a march a couple of weeks ago where some of the beat officers, I thought, were just over the top.
Really?
Inappropriate in a lot of ways. But civil affairs knows how to handle demonstrations and marches, and I always salute them and applaud them. When they're around us, we know it's going to be okay. They're a great buffer. So I think that if anything the commissioner wants to do to embolden, you know, strengthen them, I think it would be appropriate. And so my hat's off to that particular unit.
An email from Adam who says, is there a place at the table for we atheists? Much of the resistance to white supremacist movements come from the religious community. As a white non-religious person, what can we do to help in your panelists' opinion? Who do I put that to?
Well, I think, Morgan? You know, one place to go to is, you know, the espoused ideals of America. If you're an atheist, perhaps turn to say, what is America at least espouse as its highest values and ideals? We are striving for a better country. We espouse wonderful values. The issue is now living those values. So live the values that America says it believes in.
Yeah. An email from Courtney, I'll just sort of play with some of the words here, wanting to know if racism is embedded, and perhaps, Howard, I can put this to you, whether whether it has to be taught, thinking of that South Pacific song,
right.
or whether there we have sort of reactive, instinctive racism that's part of us.
I think when you define racism as broader than what's happened in Charlottesville, you get to what my colleagues have been referring to regarding these policies and practices. So in our work, we think hate is socialized. We think how you deal with hate is socialized. And you can also socialize people to speak up in the face of hate. And so that takes practice. I'm reminded of Martin Luther King in his letter from a Birmingham jail. He's talking about really to evangelicals and to religious folks about why they are so hesitant, similar to what we're seeing now. And he talks about what it's like to talk to his little 5-year-old, 6-year-old daughter that she can't go play in the amusement park that just opened up. And he describes it as watching these ominous clouds of inferiority start to form in her little mental sky. And so as early as young as 6-year-old, we know that the issue of supremacy happens in preschool expulsions, right? There's a racial disproportionality in preschool about who gets expelled. And this is an adult issue. It's not a young person issue. And so sometimes racism is what we see blatantly, but it's oftentimes unintentional. It's implicit and unconscious. And in that sense, without an explicit socialization or voicing of it, of this, we can't get to the bottom of you know, rude racism or nice racism, right? So in that respect, it's insidious. And I think the history that we've never reconciled is part of why it remains so insidious.
Mark, we're almost out of time here. I'm giving you the last word. So where do we go from here?
Well, get involved somewhere. And even back to the person, the email or message that came from the person who's an atheist, with Power, you know, at powerinterfaith.org, you can plug in anywhere. We even have the Philadelphia Ethical Society. And within their group, there's room for people who, you know, profess no religion, but they work right there with us shoulder to shoulder. This is not going to go away on its own. It's only going to go away when good people step in and do something. So don't sit at home. Get involved. And even if it's uncomfortable and painful to face yourself, we have to do it. I mean, the future is literally counting on us.
Well, my thanks to all three of you very, very much for joining us today in Radio Time. Such an important discussion, and I appreciate the work you do and what you told us this morning on Radio Times. Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church here in Philadelphia. Rabbi Mordecai Liebling, director of the Social Justice Organizing Program at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College just outside of Philadelphia. And Howard Stevenson, he's a professor of urban education and a professor of Africana Studies at the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, with help from Joyce Lieberman. Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri produce Radio Times with assistance today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.